Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Up until the 1920s, the average New Yorker ate as many as 600 local oysters a year. Back then, Americans ate twice as much fish and shellfish per capita. Butcher meat was more scarce, and much of the nation's protein came from its 94,000 miles of coastline and 3.5 million acres of rivers. Today, 91% of the seafood Americans consume comes from abroad, and yet a third of the fish and shellfish caught here is exported. Paul Greenberg makes a case for reviving America's local fisheries and production in his book, American Catch: The Fight for Our Local Seafood. The book follows the rise and the fall and attempts to revitalize production of the New York oyster, the Gulf shrimp, and the Alaskan wild sockeye salmon. Paul Greenberg will be reading and speaking at a reception tonight at the Red Door in Portsmouth. And Paul Greenberg, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
You chose these three species, the New York oyster, the Gulf shrimp, wild sockeye salmon, to illustrate different facets of America's fish and seafood supply. Now, why these three, and what do they represent?
Well, what I really wanted to talk about in this book was ecological infrastructure. In other words, the things that you need to have abundant seafood. And each one of them is kind of a part for the whole, a kind of representation of a particular kind of infrastructure that we've lost in this country. When we look at New York oysters, for example, oysters, as you mentioned at the top of the show, used to be a staple of American eating habits. And along with that, once upon a time, this country was replete in wild oyster reefs. And wild oyster reefs do a lot of really amazing things. They filter the water. The average oyster can filter about 50 gallons of water per individual per year. So in a country that had quadrillions of them, you can imagine how much cleaner the water was. But they also create structure and environment. And some of my research has shown that the presence of a functional oyster reef can actually double the amount of seafood carrying capacity that you would have in nearshore waters.
Hmm.
So that was one, you know, infrastructure thing. The next thing was really looking at shrimp and particularly in the Gulf of Mexico. And there the question was salt marsh. Salt marsh is the most productive form of, you know, ecosystem that there is out there in terms of energy production or food production. Something like 10 times more carbon is fixed by a salt marsh than a tropical rainforest. And lo and behold, shrimp are, you know, vitally interconnected with salt marshes. And lo and behold, we've lost 60 to 70% of our salt marsh in the last, you know, 100 odd years. So there's that. And then finally, with sockeye salmon, what I was really talking about was the interface between rivers and oceans. This is a key ecological moment. And once upon a time in this country, shad, herring, sturgeon, salmon, these were all the backbones of our seafood diet, and they all depended on free-flowing rivers. But if you look at places like New Hampshire, for example, we have thousands upon thousands, if not millions, of small-scale dams. I often, when I do a PowerPoint presentation, show a map of the state of Connecticut with all these dots on it. And those dots actually represent the 3,000 dams in the state of Connecticut alone.
Wow.
I often say this is why people in Connecticut are so uptight. Their chi is blocked by all those dams. But, I mean, you have them in New Hampshire as well. You have them in Massachusetts. They're everywhere. And we need to really think about this ecological infrastructure if we want to have more seafood on our plates.
Well, let's dig into one of the species you look at in the book, Gulf Coast shrimp. Shrimp, by far, the most consumed seafood in America. Yet the wild shrimp market in the Gulf Coast has been undercut by what you call the red lobster commodity model. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I often say I call shrimp sometimes the Manchurian crustacean in that once upon a time when we were first starting to ramp up our shrimp economy, and this was in the 30s and 40s and 50s, people saw it as a specialty item, as a, you know, something that you eat locally in a kind of Cajun environment, for example. But once these chain seafood stores like Red Lobster, like Long John Silver's, got people into the habit of eating a lot of shrimp, we soon found that we just didn't have enough shrimp to meet capacity. And that's where we started looking abroad to other Asian primarily to Asian shrimp fisheries, and not just fisheries, but to aquaculture. Shrimp had never really been domesticated in any large-scale way before the 1950s, say. But in the 1950s, in the 1960s, in the 1970s, you saw this incredible research and development effort, mostly in Southeast Asia, to tame first the tiger prawn and then the Pacific white leg shrimp. And now 90% of the shrimp eaten in this country are imported, and half of those are farmed, and most of those farmed shrimp are coming to us from Southeast Asia.
So cheaper coming from halfway around the world. And this is one of those distortions, it seems, of the global supply chain, which we read about in the case of at least some Alaskan salmon that you write about. Can you trace that route from ocean to plate for Alaskan sockeye salmon?
Unfortunately, it's true of a lot of seafood in this country that we can't seem to process it and eat it in the place that we catch it. There are so many different players involved. And so you take the example of, say, sockeye salmon and a lot of Alaska salmon in general. About 80% of the salmon caught in Alaska are exported. But a certain portion of them, sockeye among them, are frozen right there at the river mouths where they're caught. They are sent via sea freight to China. They're defrosted, boned and filleted, refrozen, and then sent back to the United States twice frozen. It's just this thing that seems to be prevalent. It's prevalent in the squid industry. It exists in the Alaska pollock industry. And what I've actually found out lately in talking, you know, as American catch has kind of gotten out around the world, people are writing to me in England and Scotland, and they're saying, geez, you know, the same thing's happening to us. You know, you always hear about shortages of North Sea cod, you know, as one of the drivers in overfishing. Well, turns out a certain amount of North Sea cod is getting frozen, you know, in the North Sea and sent to China, defrosted, frozen again, and sent back.
How can the economics of that possibly work? I can't.
Well, you know, a lot of it has to do with very cheap labor. In China and Thailand and other Asian countries. So that's the primary driver. And the other thing, which the California Wet Fish Association, the people who harvest squid, sardines, and anchovies told me, was that it's actually quite energy efficient to freeze and then ship across the oceans and then defrost and send back. Shipping things by sea freight is not that, you know, energy intensive. But on the other hand, you know, I think the Wet Fish Association took issue with me for bringing that up because, you know, they were saying, well, the carbon footprint is actually quite low. But I wasn't really talking about carbon footprint. In fact, the phrase I used is food miles. And food miles is really inclusive of a whole set of questions. When you export your processing to another country and you outsource it and you dismantle your own ability to process your own seafood, you're diminishing your own system. You're outsourcing your food sovereignty to another nation. So the question I'm putting out there is, yeah, it might be cheaper to send things abroad for processing, but is it better in the long run for our sense of food security to have another country deal with our own fish?
Act locally, buy milk and vegetables locally. How about fishing locally? Paul Greenberg is with us. His new book, American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood, makes a case for reviving local aquaculture. He's optimistic about the nation's ability to rebuild the infrastructure to support local fishing. Well, I wonder why you are, Paul, because any discussion of food production gets framed in this global market. You know, what's the scale that we have to operate to make it worth it? Where's our customer base? With fishing, it's right. Also policy, like the Clean Water Act you mentioned, and laws about pollutants, restrictions on overfishing, and the soaring prices of coastal property. So where do you even begin with this rebuilding of the infrastructure?
I guess if I were going to say, let's try to rebuild America's seafood infrastructure, let's start with the bottom up. If we're going to do aquaculture, let's do shellfish aquaculture. Let's farm mussels, clams, oysters, and also edible seaweeds, for example. Edible seaweeds, by the way, you know, more than 90% of the ones that we eat are coming to us again from abroad. If we were to start an aquaculture system based on bivalves and seaweed, this would do great things for cleaning the water. It doesn't require any outside sources of feed. It creates structure and habitat for other fish. So this is like a win-win-win situation. As far as getting over the question of whether or not shellfish farmers could have access to local waterfront. Well, that's a policy situation right there. I mean, I think we have to, as we start talking about ocean zoning and ocean planning, we have to make sure that adequate places are allowed on the coast for people who are actually producing food for us. It shouldn't just become a luxury recreation sector, the coast. When you talk about fishing, yeah, when you're talking about New England, you know, there are very serious shortfalls when it comes to cod. I mean, the recent release by National Marine Fisheries Service that, you know, the Gulf of Maine cod stocks are not rebuilding, that they do seem to be in bad shape. You know, other ground fish, maybe not so bad. But here's a case where I think we need to move out of the kind of commodity way of looking at fish. I don't think that, you know, commodification of cod didn't do anything very good for cod, and it didn't do anything very good for humans. Turning it into a sort of faceless slab of fish that you fry and put in a fish stick or put on a bun, I don't think is a good way to use what's fairly sensitive life out there. So I think we need to think about broadening our palate, embracing more species out there. I mean, I think there in the Northeast, you do have an overabundance of things like dogfish sharks, which, you know, can be eaten. Down here in our neck of the woods, we have, you know, an overabundance of a fish called a sea robin, which, again, is perfectly edible. But Americans are so sort of, you know, fixed in their ways about what makes a good and edible piece of fish that we're over-relying on things like cod and pushing the system too hard for things like cod when we really should be broadening our palate.
But talking about this book with people in a very unscientific way, the most frequent comment I heard from people was that they don't know what to buy. What is it? Are we supposed to buy tilapia or no? Or is pollock good? I mean, how do we know?
It depends what you're looking for. But if you're trying to, with a minimum of pollutants and maximum of omega-3s, there are a set of creatures you can be on the lookout for. Mussels, number one, very high in omega-3s, very low in toxins, very, very, very good for the environment, requires no outside feed source, filters the water. I mean, what could be better than a mussel, really? And it's delicious. I just had a delicious 2 pounds of them we went through with my family, and it was, you know, very affordable as well. So mussels are way, way atop my list. Next thing to consider, which is something I think the consumer in New England has to push for a little bit, is herring. You know, a great deal of the herring catch that comes in into Maine, New Hampshire, is actually ends up being used as lobster bait. When, in fact, herring is very high in omega-3s, again, low in toxins, a delicious piece of fish, but we don't seem to want to eat it locally.
But these are very big hurdles to get over. You're talking about consumer taste. You're talking about consumer habits. And, you know, this is here in New England where fishing fed and built economies for centuries, and now we feel very disconnected from us. So, sure. So how do you make the case, Paul Greenberg? You know, why should we concern ourselves about copper mines in Alaska if salmon is still in the supermarket?
Well, I mean, that harkens back to the last chapter of my book where, in fact, in Alaska, which Alaska in many ways resembles, from a fisheries perspective, what New England was 200 years ago, abundant codfish, abundant pollock, abundant salmon. And presently, the same sort of infrastructure threats that tore apart the fishing economy of New England are facing Alaska. In Alaska right now, for example, there is on the books an idea to put in what would be the largest copper and gold mine in North America, right at the headwaters of what is the largest sockeye salmon run left in the world, a run of about 40 million fish that comes into Bristol Bay, Alaska, every year. Why is this even being considered? Well, I argue a little bit in the book that partly it's being considered because Americans are so dissociated from those sockeye salmon, with a great majority of them going abroad, they don't even see it as part of their food security. So yes, it is a little bit of a stretch to ask Americans to seek out local seafood, to seek out American seafood. But I do believe that if we can close that loop, then we have the chance to say, look, this is our food and this is the system that allows this food to exist. If we don't integrate consumption with environmental protection, then I think that we're going to lose a lot more coastal viability, and we're even going to lose, you know, these real seafood engines of the country like Alaska.
Paul Greenberg, I want to thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Paul Greenberg, author of American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. We previously spoke to him about his best-selling book, Four Fish. He's in Portsmouth, New Hampshire tonight at a reception sponsored by River Run Books. It's at the Red Door and it's at 5 o'clock. You'll find more information at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for a conversation with filmmaker Jay Craven. He's been hauling in the local scenery and the stories and characters of northern New England for decades. We'll speak with him about the joys and challenges of regional filmmaking when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we were talking about eating locally caught seafood. Filmmaker Jay Craven knows what it means to stay local. He is a passionate advocate for what he calls regionally based indigenous cinema and co-founder of Kingdom County Films based in Northeast Vermont. That's also the setting for his latest film, Northern Borders, starring Academy Award nominee Bruce Dern. The film is currently touring towns across New Hampshire. We spoke to him late last year about the power of place-based movie making.
People do exist within a cultural framework that includes narrative. Certainly we all think of our own stories, and many of those stories are very much related to place. And, you know, my experience has been that working with stories that are rooted in our place resonates in a way that really commercial media and movies in general do not, which isn't to say that I don't enjoy going to the movies as much as everybody else. I see a lot of movies because I teach film and I've got two boys that I've raised, and movies were always part of our routine. But a story that really is rooted in character and place resonates in a different way, partly because if it's a good film, it brings fresh perspective to the place that we live and stimulates us to think about it in other ways, ways that add dimension. There's a danger, in fact, that we begin to perceive where we live according to the stereotypes that are associated with it, that are actually imposed sort of externally.
Let's talk about the sensation and sense of place in your films. You've made five films now based on novels by the Northeast Kingdom writer Howard Frank Mosher. So talk about a little about the role of Vermont as a setting and a sort of character of its own in his books, and how you create that sense of place on film.
Well, part of what has always appealed to me about Mosher's work is that it is not strictly a literal treatment of Vermont as place or an ultra-realistic portrait. I mean, the characters are a bit larger than life, frequently, although there are elements of realism that are made a part of it. And in some ways, there are mythic dimensions to some of the stories. My films, inevitably, when they go into release, get categorized as Westerns, in fact, which is sort of interesting. But Mosher looks at the North Country as a frontier, and that interested me, partly because I was raised by a Texas grandmother that took me to Tennessee Williams pictures and Westerns when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. So in approaching it, it was a way to sort of reimagine my own experience of the place and the characters that I've come to know and you know, the ways in which we all sort of root ourselves here. And so there's an element of fun in it as much as anything, and an ironic sense of humor that I've also found appealing.
Bill Kaufman wrote about you and your work in his article about regional filmmaking in Orion magazine, and pointed out that there are only 18 Vermont towns that have movie theaters. So how do you and other filmmakers get your movies in front of audiences?
Well, partly because this is a populist enterprise, we also commit ourselves to what we call a 100-town tour as the first wave of release for any of the films that we've made. They later go and get shown on Showtime or get DVD releases and the rest. But we focus in the first wave of playing small towns, and literally 100 towns in Vermont. So there are 18 towns that have theaters, which means we're playing fire stations and town halls and granges and school auditoriums. We also like to look at the region as more than Vermont. If you live in the Adirondacks, you tend to look at the North Country as a swath that goes, that starts in the Adirondacks and goes all the way through to the coast of Maine. Mm-hmm. And I sort of like that idea, that it's not broken down by state so much. And we certainly found a fabulous response in New Hampshire. Every audience is different. And my argument has been, in fact, that New England as a whole is a region that is worth exploring. Actually, of all the regions in the country, polls have shown that people here feel more connected to place than in any other part of the country, strangely perhaps. Uh-huh. But and maybe it's also because there is a cultural longevity and a tradition of small town and community that sort of keeps us connected. And that's another element that very much comes into play in the films that I do. I compare them to Westerns, but in the West, towns were forming for the first time. When you deal with mythic and frontier themes in a New England picture, you're dealing with a place that has a history and a cultural tradition and a connection to family and small town.
Jay Craven of Kingdom County Films. He's a professor of film studies at Marlborough College in Vermont and writer and director of Northern Borders. The film is currently on tour in towns across New Hampshire, including the Monadnock Center in Peterborough, the Claremont Opera House, and Exeter's Town Hall. You'll find a full list of venues and dates at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, in the digital age, or so they say, it doesn't matter where you're based. What matters is getting your message out and hoping it sticks. Here's a hint. Write short. Some lessons in effective brevity. Coming up after the break.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. By now, you've likely heard about the brilliant six-word story attributed to Ernest Hemingway. For sale, baby shoes, never worn. Hemingway was a methodical master of economy, editing his own work with extreme care, sometimes taking a full morning to write a single paragraph. In other words, the antithesis of how we communicate today, when being the first to tweet something snarky is valued above getting it right. How then to tell a story to convey meaning and evoke real feeling in 140 characters or less? Our guest believes that we can embrace this fast-paced world of micro-messages without sacrificing literary values. Roy Peter Clark, vice president and senior scholar at the Poynter Institute and author of How to Write Short, Wordcraft for Fast Times. That book is now out in paperback, and we welcome you, Roy Peter Clark, to Word of Mouth.
Virginia, it's my pleasure.
This is the fourth in a series of books on writing and journalism. This comes to us at a time when much of what we read is considered clickbait, you know, designed to grab eyeballs and clicks, and is criticized in many circles as dumbing down writing. Can brevity be smart and be deep?
Well, the inspiration for this particular book turns out to be a public radio personality, Scott Simon, the NPR weekend anchor. We were both at a book festival a few years ago, and he gave the keynote, and he told a story, a lesson that his stepfather taught him, and the stepfather said to him, "You know, Scott, they say that a picture's worth 1,000 words, and we've probably all seen pictures that we thought were worth thousands of words." He said, "But think about this. Think about these historical texts. Think about the Hippocratic Oath, the Lord's Prayer, the 23rd Psalm, any Shakespeare sonnet, the preamble to the Constitution, mm-hmm. the Gettysburg Address, and let's throw in the last paragraph of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech that people quote so often." And he said, "Take those seven texts, historical texts, and add them up, and you get fewer than 1,000 words. Now, I didn't believe this. And some of these documents come in at different lengths. But I was finally able to assemble a collection of those documents that equaled 996 words. And I said, wow, the lesson is that we've always reserved the most important messages for the shortest texts. Which was sometimes some of my friends refer to as the Jesus wept effect, the shortest sentence in the Bible. Two words, subject and verb.
Well, your first bit of advice to writers who would like to aspire to that kind of writing and write short is to read short. What are some of your favorite sources for good short writing?
Well, what's interesting is that they come from all different places. You know, they come from historically. In the era before the digital age, We have everything from proverbs from the Bible. We have the things that people write on gravestones. We have short poems. We have sayings that people repeat over and over again. For example, I have some favorites. So one of my favorites is the title of a poem by T.S. Eliot, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock.
Mm-hmm.
And I hold that up against one of my favorite television show titles of all time, which is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And what does Buffy have to do with J. Alfred Prufrock? And the answer to that is that in both of those titles, the two key elements don't seem to go together. Of all the names that you would try to construct to accompany the phrase love song, I don't think J. Alfred Prufrock would be high on the list.
Mm-hmm.
So T.S. Eliot places some sort of creative tension between the romantic element and the sort of banker identity of that name. And then the case of Buffy, for generations, the vampire slayer was named Professor Van Helsing or
right,
something like that.
Right.
And so to make the savior of the universe a 16-year-old blonde California high school girl was Joss Whedon's wonderful invention. And when she happens to die, although she's brought back to life, like after the third or fourth season, we see her gravestone and it says on it, the epitaph, it says, "She saved the world a lot." And so I had more fun writing this book than any book I've ever written. And it has to do with how interesting, creative, and important examples of short writing are, like over time. Can I give you one more quick example?
Sure, please.
So it occurred to me as I was looking at Twitter and Facebook messages that perhaps an analogy could be found in the telegrams of the first half of the 20th century, because those messages were sold by the word,
yeah.
And therefore economy meant something on two levels. And so I have a collection of famous messages, but one of my favorites is when the Hollywood Reporter sends a telegram to Cary Grant because he's writing a profile about him and he wants a detail that he doesn't have. And so the original telegram said, "How old Cary Grant?" To which the famous actor replied, "Old Cary Grant, fine. How you?" So we get humor. We get pathos in the messages that were sent home from the war front in World War II. We get all kinds of interesting insights into human life, and many of them are within 6 words or 10 words or within 140 characters.
We're talking about writing short with one of America's most influential writing teachers. Roy Peter Clark is with us. He's author of several books, including a recent series on writing. The most recent is now in paperback, How to Write Short, Wordcraft for Fast Times. So T-shirts, bumper stickers, baseball cards, Shakespearean sonnets and excerpts from plays. These are many of your sources for good short writing, including song lyrics. In the book, you interpret the Tom Petty song Free Fallen. First, why this song?
Well, you know, I've played in garage bands since I was I guess probably since I was 12 years old, trying to figure out what the lyrics to Louie Louie really meant. So,
how'd you make out?
Well, I discovered that they weren't as nasty as our parents thought they were. I guess I've always been attuned to the economy of the lyric as a short form of writing and as a form of poetry. And there was something haunting in Free Falling that I wanted to sort of discover the sources of that and what it would teach us about writing in general.
Well, let's listen to just a clip.
She's a good girl, loves her mama, loves Jesus in America too. She's a good girl, is crazy about Elvis, loves horses and her boyfriend too.
And that's just a line from Tom Petty's 1989 song, Free Fallin'. So what is it that stands out about this for you?
Well, here's what I wrote about it. I just happened to sort of land on that in the book. And it says, I wrote, the half line that gets me every time, so much that I appear to hear it above the rest, is crazy about Elvis.
Hmm.
She could love the Beatles or the Birds, but chooses Elvis to love, a bad boy in his own right, whose addictions will lead to an early grave. Think of the phrase, crazy about Elvis, as a kind of grace note that is a small, almost exquisite ornament in music, most surprising when it turns out to be the only decoration.
Brilliantly chosen, huh?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Before we close, I just have to ask you about your job at Poynter. I mean, that's a prestigious journalism school. And there is a lot of concern in journalism, especially about long-form writing, long-form investigative pieces. It's not something that's easy to fund anymore. Now, you, in writing and encouraging people to write shorter, would you be happy if people everybody started writing shorter? And if so, what gets lost in that edit?
Well, here's what I would say. Short writing and long writing are cousins rather than enemies. And what I mean by that is that it's very often the short piece of writing that will grow into a longer narrative or a book. Remember, you're talking to a man who has written a book about short writing.
Mm-hmm. It's not just a web post.
Exactly. And the other thing that happens is that longer writing, long-form journalism or narrative or fiction, requires elements of short writing to make it stick. We can all think of all of the famous long novels that we read and were formative on our lives have memorable short titles. You know, War and Peace, The Grapes of Wrath. And so there are chapter titles to be written. Now, in the digital age, it's very often short forms of writing that promote longer forms of writing, that link to important works of journalism or literature. So once again, I think versatility is the writer's virtue of the day.
Well, Roy Peter Clark, thank you very much for your short and long lessons for us today.
Thank you, Virginia.
Roy Peter Clark, Vice President and Senior Scholar at Poynter. His latest book is called How to Write Short, Wordcraft for Fast Times. It's the fourth in a series of books about writing by Clark, and it's now out in paperback. You find link to more on all four books and an excerpt from How to Write Short and to his blog with all sorts of tips, short ones, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for an unguarded conversation with the actor and comedian Robin Williams, who died yesterday. The international superstar opened up to fellow comedian Marc Maron about divorce, depression, and turning comedy into therapy. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The news of Robin Williams' death reverberated across social media channels yesterday and today, with many in the world of comedy tweeting their shock and condolences. Among them, Steve Martin, who wrote, "I could not be more stunned by the loss of Robin Williams, mensch, great talent, acting partner, genuine soul." Judd Apatow tweeted, "When I was 18, I got a job as an intern at Comic Relief, just to be near him. A genius and a truly kind man who made the world a better place." And Ellen DeGeneres, who wrote, "I can't believe the news about Robin Williams. He gave so much to so many people. I'm heartbroken." Stand-up comedian Mark Maron's response was short, painful, and captured what so many may have felt. "God damn it, Robin Williams. Sorry." In 2010, Robin Williams was a guest on Mark Maron's podcast, WTF. Perhaps Williams was feeling open that day, or maybe there's an unspoken bond of trust between comics. But this interview is startling in its intimacy and cuts through the vocal impressions and the almost manic energy associated with Robin Williams. Throughout the interview, Williams takes off the masks and candidly discusses his divorce, his battle with alcoholism and addiction, his insecurities and depression. Here's a snippet from that conversation where they discuss Robin Williams' frenetic stand-up style, why he's always opted against using a traditional handheld mic.
But I think that whole no mic thing really defines, you know, still that. Because when I go off mic, the control you have of a room changes dramatically.
Totally. People are forced to kind of go, what?
Yeah, they're like, take it in. And so you were able to sort of like, you
but
know,
I know guys who do that, you know, who really... That's why when I do stand-up, I use a wireless mic. This is hard for me to go, okay, good evening, thanks. And it seemed to me almost old school to go, hi, everybody, nice to be
holding
here. Holding the mic. And when I've had to go do clubs where I do, I leave it in the stand and kind of come and go to it. It's almost like, come back, point of reference, come back. But it was also the thing, I got to move, a moving target, literally.
And you still, like, you know, you still, like, put it out there, man. I mean,
but you got to. For me, and the reason, like, when we go on at the Comedy Cellar, it's therapy. It's a relief from that, like you said, of where you can go on stage, and especially like you go on stage late, and like you said, with an audience, it's kind of especially, I don't know, there's certain audiences where they go, okay, so something new.
Right. And they're a little beaten up. If you go on late, you know, and it's half
they're
a
beaten
house
up, and then they're going, and then you know if you find something new, it's new. Then it's new and also different, or really honest, or really, like you said, deep, or just crazy.
But I think the personal truth, you know, becomes more daunting. For me,
it's a difficult thing to
well,
do.
Well, you know, it's like if you want to, you know, pontificate or take a soapbox, which I've done plenty of in my life, and I'm just at this point, and I'm a little younger than you, where it seems to me that the real risk, the one thing that all of us share, is that existential, you know, fear, that, you know, the panic of, you know, what does it really all mean?
Big time.
You know, what do we do with this anger? And
what do you do with the anger? And what do you do with the beneath the anger is the fear, like you said. What's the fear?
Yeah,
and
I think
about that, and you talk about it to a 20-something, and they're going, because they're like immune at that point.
Well, yeah, I do a bit about how like I've gotten old enough to resent people for being young. Like, and I'll ask someone in the audience, how old are you? And if they go like 22, I go, you know, f- you. And they don't really know what to do with that because there's no way they can...
Like, they can't fathom that.
Well, I do the podcast. You know who can fathom it? There's this... Like, I get emails from 14 to 18-year-old guys saying, uh-huh, you know, I really understand where you're at, the frustration, all this stuff. And then when they get about 20, you know, 20 to 35, which is the prime demographic, I got nothing for them. But, you know, 18... 14 to 18-year-old kids, they understand the fear and the pain and everything else.
Oh,
and then
God,
the cocky time comes. And then when you get in your mid-30s, they're like, oh, now I get it. So I've alienated the only profitable demographic. I'm very clever like that.
You're basically
18
clever.
To 25, no. Yeah, yeah.
That's why I wanted to talk about Twitter to me. I go, Twitter, why would I... Twitter, the next step for me is stalker. You know, I'm having lunch. I know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how do you now? Like, I noticed, and now with the last one, the weapons of mass self-destruction. Was that what it was?
Yeah.
That you are taking... You know, more risks than you have before with your own life and yourself.
I am, but it's also, you know, it's that weird thing of still talking kind of in general terms versus hardcore specific terms, which is like that thing that you leave either for... At one point, I had a therapist go, are you comfortable talking about this? I went, maybe, you know. It's that idea of, like I told you with Chris, he was talking about stuff. I went, wow, would that I had the... You know, but at the time, I was in the middle of a divorce. You're going, not good. Initially, I was going to call the tour Remember the Alimony, and they went, maybe not.
Yeah, yeah. Not until we get the paper signed.
You're not paying alimony, number one. Number two, not profitable. And the idea of...
Well, that's bitter. There's a line where...
Yeah, I mean, someone said recently that they saw John Cleese, who was going through this divorce, and he was on stage, and he was so angry that the audience at one point was like, stop, you know.
Right, because bitterness is not... I tried to sell it for a long time, and it's really just amplified self-pity.
Totally.
And it reads that way.
And people kind of go, I get it, but you move on. You know.
Right, like, that's the weird thing about people, is that, you know...
going, if you can talk... It's that old acting thing. The more personal you make it, the more specific you make it, the more people will relate to you. Because they'll go, as personal as you think it is, there's a lot of people going, I feel that.
Well, that's where you get them. But, you know, where to get that in comedy is a little trickier.
Yeah, because you walk over that line and going, I feel this and I want to burn. And you go, no, we don't feel that.
Right, exactly.
Or they go, don't share that part.
Well, then you have to accept that idea that where they can, you know, where either they laugh with you or they laugh at you. At some point, you have to be comfortable if they're laughing at you.
You're comfortable with either one laughing at you. Can you tolerate that? And that's maybe sometimes where I go, oh, go! You know, the insecure part goes, no.
What are you afraid will happen?
I guess it's that fear of you'll recognize that, how insecure are we really?
Yeah.
How desperately insecure that made us do this for a living?
Well, I went to your IMDb page, and over the 25 years of appearance changes, I think that they can...
Big time going, why the beard? You have a beard. You're fat, you're cool, you're thin, you're light, you're blonde hair, you're bald. It's that weird thing. But those are a lot of times for characters. But it's the idea of at what point, you know, what level of acceptance, like you said. And look what we do for a living in terms of stand-up. You get to do stuff that if you did it, you know, just on the street, people go, that man.
Yeah.
He talked about his to me openly.
Right.
And you're going, but you're doing it in a club. All of a sudden, there's license to thrill, that old thing. You can do this stuff. But, like you said, the line, stepping over and back over the line of like, what are you going to find out? You're going to find out that, you know, you're this weird, insecure guy who does this and looking like Lenny Bruce said, for love. Going, do you love me?
Yeah.
Temporarily?
Yeah.
Kind of?
Yeah.
And then, and can you put that at risk going, I don't care if you love me, I got to say this.
Our next comedian comes from San Francisco, where he performed with the improv comedy group called The Wing. He moved to Los Angeles last winter and quickly became a regular here at the Improv. His humor is reminiscent of the great British comedians. You may have already seen him on The New Laugh, and please welcome Robin Williams.
America, beach and boss country. Thank you. California. Okay. Thank you. Cheap shot. No way. I'd like to thank my father for coming. It's okay if I take off coat in public here? So let's keep it. Okay. I keep it back on before it. Okay, wow. Another reason to legalize abortion in America. Okay.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, here we go. A Soviet poem of pain and suffering. Little Robin, upon my windowsill with tiny breast of red, I brought the window slowly down and crushed the sucker's head. He's old, but sometimes works. And now, you're okay. Don't go down on yourself, it's okay. What are you doing? You all right? Okay, you're having a good time throwing up, no? Okay. Before I go on, I wish to teach you one word in Russian in case you ever go... Can you hear me in the seats over there? Okay, here we go. I wish to teach you one word in Russian in case you ever go to Soviet Union. It's necessary to know. It's a phrase, I'm sorry. A phrase to know in Soviet Union. Rozby, vospoyine shozby. Why am I under arrest? Okay. We are ready now. Save that water for the shortage. Here we go.
Robin Williams there, who died yesterday at 63 of an apparent suicide. And with that, we gotta say goodbye for today. You'll find much more to explore at wordofmouthradio.org, where we've posted a link to hear the entire 2010 interview between Williams and Marc Maron. You can also chime in with your memories or thoughts on Williams on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott, thinking today that word of mouth is the oldest form of remembering those who've passed. along with our joys and our wonder at the world. We'll be sharing more tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio and online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.